Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Tunbridge Wells. Welcome to the Assembly Hall Theatre. Please welcome a man with a strangely rattling scrotum. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Yeah, not as good as last week's audience, that's what has to be said. Welcome to the show. Love to see you all. Thanks for coming along. This is Richard Herring's Little Supermarket for Tunbridge Wells podcast. The Little's a good supermarket. That's perfectly fine for you guys. You don't need anything. Don't need anything else. You got a Little. There's a Tesco there. You're well served. Can't get those nice. Ah, oh, I love those little fruit salads you can get at Waitrose. Don't know what I'd do without those. The mushroom stir fry. Oh, it's so good. I was at the UK Owl and Raptor Centre the other day. It's basically I was expecting to be Royal Tunbridge Wells' Jurassic Park. I was looking forward to seeing the raptors. I have to say, wasn't so bothered about the owls. But I thought there were going to be some raptors there. This would be good. It was mainly owls. There was very few dinosaurs there at all. I should have been suspicious. Anyway, the owls call it Rahalastapa. That's good. I always like to check the front page of the local newspaper to see what kind of place I'm in. I looked at the front page of the Tunbridge Wells Times, which looks like it's from 1894. I genuinely had to check it wasn't a reproduction on the internet that I genuinely did. Although this is getting people. Remember, the headline of a newspaper is trying to encourage people to buy the newspaper. Some big piece of news. I have to buy the Tunbridge Wells Times this week. Council proposes mandatory card payments for all taxis. That's the big headline news. I mean, hey, it's sort of, it might as well be fucking 1894 if it isn't, or if you can't already pay for all your taxes on card.
This is the 21st century. Who has cash anymore? But I saw that. I thought, blimey, I better buy the paper to read more about that. I went down to Pantiles, where the streets are tiled with pants. On a Friday night, from what I've witnessed in the Royal Victoria Place complex before I came. I was there at 5 o'clock, and the schools were just out, and they were already pretty frisky. The police were involved. So well done. You don't live up to the stereotype all the time, Royal Tunbridge Wells, so congratulations on that. So look, I will just have a quick run through what I'll be doing after the show. I'm going to run out to the foyer before you. And I was just talking to my guest about this, who said he saw Alvin Stardust do the same thing. Alvin Stardust and the Grumbleweeds, they were out in the foyer before the audience. You're not going to believe how quickly I'm out there. I have cards. You can pay by cash or card. It's not mandatory. Not yet. As I said, there's some stickers and cards. There's all the different emergency questions books. Would you rather? There's a book I'm going to ask, I guess, some of those. There's some little emergency questions books that fit in the pocket. One of them is Christmas emergency questions. What a great gift that would be coming up for Christmas. Right, let's crack on. Hopefully my guest has made himself a cup of tea by now. He is probably local. He lives in Royal Tunbridge Wells. He's probably best known as high-class customer in Westlife's version of Uptown Girl. We only get the good guests. Will you please welcome the actually incredible Robert Bathurst, ladies and gentlemen. Mate, it's Robert Bathurst from Uptown Girl.
Thank you.
Lovely to see you, Robert.
I get a mug.
You've got a free mug. It's a good size.
Yeah, there are three of us in this show. There's you, me, and your merch.
How do I compare to Alvin Stardust and the Grumbleweeds, though? That is the question.
Yeah, I saw Alvin Stardust on the North Pier at Blackpool. And I went out pretty quick at the end of it, but Alvin was already in the foyer, and I see if you can beat that.
I can beat Stardust. do you remember being in the Westlife?
That was the beginning and the end of my pop career. That was got to number one.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. It was a comic relief video for Uptown Girl with Claudia Schiffer in a diner somewhere in North London. And the boys were eventually... there were various ones like Johan Griffith and Tim McInerney. We were all smart in sort of dinner suits and stuff, going. We were meant to be meeting Claudia Schiffer and taking her out, and the Westlife boys got her in the end.
Yeah, so. Well, they would do, wouldn't they?
Yeah. It was great. It was fascinating to watch it. I mean, to make a pop video, never done one before, but we were saying things, the actors were in it, and we were saying things to the director, like, what's the continuity here? He went, continuity, it is a pop video. It was the only one I've ever done, but we did get to number one, that's it.
Yeah. That's a win. Did you sing on the record?
No, I don't think you got
to number one then, Robert. Yeah, I don't think.
I'm claiming it. We were on top of the pops in number one. Thank you very much. There we are.
I think the kids in We Don't Need No Education have a better shot.
Yeah, they go. Yeah, she's got more of a claim.
That's good. Look, it's so lovely to see you. I was saying backstage, I think the last time I saw you was when we did quite a it's always a horrible thing to do, but we did a table read of one of my scripts for BBC executives in a horrible boardroom. They're all sitting at one end. Yeah. It was a very nice cut. It was the show that went on to be You Can Choose Your Friends on ITV and then went to be on Relativity on the radio. Robert didn't want to be in either of those. And I should have known your character was in the radio version. Timothy West was there as well. It was
That's
pretty
right.
amazing.
Yeah. So you did, it had various iterations, didn't it?
Up and down. It's unusual to go from TV to then being a radio show. I've done it backwards, and then it'll just be me in my attic, just with puppets.
Yeah,
that's the way it goes. I didn't know this about you either. I don't think that you were in the kind of glory days, really, of the Cambridge Footlights. I mean, I'm amazed it was 1977 because you do not look old enough to have been. You must have been 10 years old.
I feel it.
Okay. But you were in the Cambridge Footlights the kind of couple of years before Stephen Fry, Emma Thompson, but you must have been contemporaries with them.
Well, I mean, they were there when I was 30. Yeah, I did. We toured Australia with Stephen, Hugh and Emma in a show after they left, and we did a show all around Australia. In 1981, England had just beaten Australia in the Test match, and so we called the show. It was a review about nothing in particular, but we called the show Botham the Musical. So just for the sake of it, and they really foxed all the Australian press when they just wanted to get who's the guy who plays Botham. We wanted to take a photograph, and it wasn't. It was a nonsense title, and it was just at them. That was the only point of it.
Yeah. So was that before they sort of went?
That was before they did Alfresco. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to be doing what I'm doing now, which is acting. Yeah. I didn't want to be a straight man for Jimmy Melville or any other sort of option that was happening, and to do sketches. I couldn't. I mean, I'm not a comedian. I don't do, and I do comedy and stuff, but comedy dramas and stuff, but I didn't want to do sketch shows. And I couldn't see anybody over 33 in sketch shows. This is when I was about 23. And so I went into a show in the West End and went on from there.
Yeah.
And the rest is mystery.
But, you know, you say you're not... I mean, you are very funny, and you've played a stand-up comedian in one of my favourite 20th century sitcoms.
Brilliant. Yeah, my favourite job ever. Yeah.
Joking Apart, which was I think, like, again, it was... It did very well, but I think it's sort of, you know, it doesn't get the credit it deserves. It was an early Stephen Moffat.
It was one of his first. He wrote Press Gang, and then he wrote Joking Apart, then he wrote Coupling after that. And Joking Apart was the producer, Andrei Tuschinski, said to Stephen, who he liked his writing, and said, "What makes you laugh?" And he said, "Well, I've just been divorced. That's pretty funny." And so he wrote this thing called Joking Apart, which was... had these stand-up sequences in it, which actually were its downfall in some ways, because they were just played into the audience. They were to spin the narrative along. And so I was in a club and I was doing the thing and I'm wearing a shiny suit, I mean, and all that. And they were just to play into the studio audience, to spin the narrative along. And they said that we'll reshoot those, but they never had the money to reshoot them.
Right.
So they went in. That was on the first series. And then Seinfeld came along, which of course was about stand-up, well, much more.
Yeah.
And we did a second series, and people said, "Well, that's Steinfeld's done that." And we said, "Well, no, we did it." And we had about 3 years between series, and it was a very frustrating. But I have to say, of the 12 episodes that we made, that Stephen wrote, I reckon 8 of them are just brilliant classic farces which will endure. And people still talk about them. For a long time, I used to get stopped by drunks in public transport telling me the plot of their favourite episode of Joking Apart. it was most enjoyable and well-written comedy I've ever done.
Yeah, it's apart from the one.
Apart from yours,
the
of course.
The table
company the table accepted, of course.
Until I got that script. It's too good, I can't be in it. But is it true that you feel responsible for it not getting a third series? I heard a story that you thought you'd put the mockers on the third.
God, yeah. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, I should say, Joking Apart took 5 years, 4 or 5 years to make the two series. It was the most frustrating period because I mean, we all adored the show and people were enjoying it. But anyway, so yes, we made the second series, and then, if you insist, Christmas 1993 BBC Two Christmas party. And we all had to queue up in a royal procession for the then head of BBC Two, who was, and I'd had a couple. If you're an American, you go, yeah, and you run with.
Yeah.
You run with, I suppose it's an improv thing, you run with an idea and you develop it and you expand it. And if you're too British, you undercut it. And, you know, I suppose maybe that's the analysis of it. But anyway, so he said, he's in the queue, he said, great, we've just done the second series of Joking Apart. We'll repeat series one and two together and then we'll make series three in the summer. To which the reply was, "Michael, that was just fantastic. I think that's a really good idea." Mm-hmm. But he said, and he also said, I want the viewing figures. He did this sort of media graph with his hand. He said, "I want the viewing figures." She said, to go like Everest, like that. And I just said, "Well, Everest goes down the other side." So we never made series three. Series two was never repeated. But and because it was a Stephen wrote this character who never takes anything seriously and always comes back with a, he said, "At least we went out on a one-liner," he said.
Weirdly, I went to a BBC Christmas party. It must have been about 19, it must have been a couple of years after that, because we were doing Fist of Fun, and I got very drunk, and me and Stephen Moffat, there was a big Christmas tree, but it was sort of up some steps. we tried to climb up the Christmas tree, and I remember crawling up this gantry with Stephen Moffat behind me. So, you know, it's probably his fault.
Yeah, probably his fault
that we... I never got invited back. And I did that awful thing where I said... I met someone and said, oh, you were in my favourite ever sitcom. And he went, really? What sitcom was that? And we said, you were in Citizen Smith. He said, no, I wasn't. I was in Brushstrokes.
Yeah.
Never invited back. So, but look, I mean, there's so much that we could talk about that you've been in, and we will try and get through as much of it as possible. I was very interested to hear that you were nearly one of the men in That's Life, one of the men who sat behind Esther in That's Life. In fact, you got the job to be that guy, right?
Does anybody remember That's Life?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was in my early 20s, and I had my agent put me in for That's Life, and I wanted to do what I'm doing at the moment. I didn't want to be a TV presenter, so I lied my way through the auditions. I lied to Esther Ranson. I'm sorry, I did. I lied to Esther Ranson. And I said how much I wanted to do it. We did three rounds of auditions. And, we went into a studio with loads of people in the audience, and there were two hopefuls on either side of Esther doing the quips. I turned it down. But I mean, somebody else did it brilliantly. But I knew that if I was going to do that job, I would never be able to. It would always be on my record, as it were. You'd always be referred to as one of Esther's boys.
Yeah, many of them have. I mean, a couple of them had sort of slightly journalistic careers, and they were journalistic in inverted commas, but it was a hard thing to escape. But if that were, why did you go through the whole process of doing the audition?
Well, I was young and just sort of flailing, I'm still up to doing anything. I was trying, you know, and also I had no certainty that I knew through the audition process when they asked me to research and present a program on the smelliest piggery in South Wales. I knew that was dead. I didn't want that as my future. Really.
No, I think you made the right choice.
Maybe. I'll tell you what the difficulty was, of course. That's Life was getting, and it seems odd now to think about that, but it was getting 18 million people a week watching it. I took a very unambitious job at the National Theatre, holding a spear and saying one line for 4 months. So standing there in my chainmail and tights and balaclava, with my balaclava pulled down over my eyes and up over my nose, so that no friend could recognise me, and holding the spear, and I was thinking I could be opening supermarkets by now. So I'm glad I didn't.
I think it was sort of interesting to think of those moments. And the choices you make. I mean, not that I think there was ever really any chance of you doing that job, but I always go back, and I've done this a few times, but I go back to Paul McCartney after Hamburg, came back and worked at a factory and was offered a promotion, and the Beatles didn't do anything for a few months. And then John Lennon came and said, we're doing these gigs at the Cavern at lunchtime, would you come down? And he was offered a promotion. Yeah. So we had to choose between doing a proper job and getting more money, yeah, or giving it up and going and being the Beatles. Yeah. That would have been a bigger change than you being in That's Life or not. No offence, Robert.
On balance.
But yeah. Imagine if he'd chosen, and do you think he would have still gone back to music, or we'd just never have had any of that?
It's a fantastic thought. I mean, there's a rather good film in that, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of films basically about that idea.
Are there?
Okay. Well, sort of, like alternative reality, you know, that's what Yesterday sort of is.
Sliding
Doors, don't bring that up. I can't be careful when I slag off, because you are in absolutely everything from the last 40 years. So I will have to be careful.
I tell you, there are lots of stuff in my CV which, since my 20s, I've been putting the two credits in italics of productions. You know, you have also seen in and stuff like that. And I've done lots of episodes of stuff, and it's in, over the years. And so I put in two made-up credits, and I've been doing that for about 30 years. And it's still in my CV. It's still on, I think it's on IMDb. I think it's still there. And it's official. And so one of them came about when I was on the tube in Brixton in my late 20s. And somebody, I used to do adverts and stuff like that. I used to keep the family going. And somebody stopped me on the, well, she was getting off the tube. It was a terminal, so there was time. And she got off the tube and she came back on again and said, you're on the telly, aren't you? And I said, yeah, sometimes. And she said, my friend wants to know what you've been in. And I said, I didn't have my CV on me. I said, well, I know, just, you know, the odd thing. And she called down to her friend, he was in the odd thing. So I've used that in my CV. TV also includes the odd thing. And then I add to it, over time, there are various episodes of stuff which either for space or shame, I don't mention. And that comes under, I just put that in italics. Next door to the odd thing, I put in loads of tosh. And when we did the Cold Feet stuff, all took off, and there was publicity for that. And they may have read my theatre programme because it said, under my photograph in their brochure, it said, star of TV's The Odd Thing and loads of tosh. It's official.
Well, you've done more than The Odd Thing. I can't think
of an actor who hasn't been in loads of tosh.
Now I worry that some of the credits I'm going to read out weren't real, so we'll see. I do remember you in the first episode of Red Dwarf.
I've been killed in the first episodes of Red Dwarf and Hornblower.
Right, that's pretty impressive.
I was turned into a pile of sherbet in the first episode of Red Dwarf. Very annoyingly, I was working in Manchester and they asked me to sort of resurrect the character just for an episode of Todd Hunter, that was his name. And so I was very upset. I'd love to have gone back and done that. Shame. But yeah, we did. I was nuked in the first one, and blown up in Hornblower.
Well, so you know they both did pretty well those series, so maybe that's a
did very
good
well
luck.
Me.
Kill Bathurst in episode one. Though Cold Feet, you survived that, and that's done all right as well.
Actually, I've not only been blown up and stuff, I've been hit an awful lot. I think two actors are divided into those who hit and those who get hit. And I'm definitely the other, this one. Yeah. And so I did I had a website at one stage. I'm not very tech savvy. I had a website at one stage and it got taken over by Chinese, I think. I can't remember where it is now. Anyway, there was a button on it called Greatest Hits, which was my compilation of me being punched and kicked and killed and blown up in various shows over the years. But I may try and find that again.
Yeah, it would be good to see. I mean, you've got that's a little bit of a... The characters you play, I would say, sometimes have a little bit of a punchable face.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, but also, I agree.
It happens to be your face as well, Robert.
Yeah, and guns. I can't really hold an automatic weapon within great authority, you know. So I generally on the receiving end.
Yeah, terrific. I'm not even going to go in order because there's things that I really want to talk about in just in case we don't get time. But look, I have to mention Toast of London, which is, I mean, that's a it was maybe an unusual choice for you after having done quite a few mainstream sitcoms, and you've done something like Cold Feet, and Toast of London is quite out there.
Well, I mean, I that's the principle of working. I mean, yeah. Always, if something seems... When I first read Toast, I thought, what is this? Which was the reason for doing it.
Yeah.
Because it just seemed completely unlike anything I'd seen before or read before. And it wasn't until I was filming the pilot that I began to understand really what it was. And I like people who've got art school backgrounds as well. I just think there's so many Oxbridge English people in the media who know everything. They got the answer to absolutely everything. And I like working with art school people. Art school people throw it up and see what lands.
Yeah.
So two in particular, Matt Berry and a cartoonist called Charles Petey, I've done stage shows with. And they just have a different approach to things. Matt's a jazzer. He's a musician, really good musician, but his whole attitude is jazz, and that came through in the writing of it. So yeah, I mean, it might well have not worked, and in fact, the first series nobody wrote about it, and it was going to get pulled, and then the second series Matt won an award for it, and people started to come around to it, and we've only done done two of Toast of London, and then he went and did the Hollywood one.
Yeah,
I love it because it's got its own language, and also comedy names are really difficult. If you see read a sitcom and everybody's called Blenkinsop and Chumley or whatever, and if they're trying too hard with the names, but the way what Matt and Arthur do is they like fridge magnet names from two connections, and they spend months sort of finding name pairings that work. And so you have Kikini Bamalam and Pookie Hook and all those other ones. Yep. And rather enjoyably, a racing trainer has named characters after characters in Toast. They named horses after characters in Toast. And I have to say, Hauser Black has won 5 races.
Someone reminded me on Twitter, and I think I should ask you about the episode with Bruce Forsyth, who you've mentioned, the character. That's quite an extraordinary... I watched it again today. It's quite an extraordinary scene, isn't it?
It has. It is. It's... does anybody remember that one episode? Right. I mean, it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary, and it's very difficult to describe. And when people say what is Toast, and people who've seen it, the converted go, Toast in London, like that. But people who haven't, of course, they're as blank as I was when I first read it, and they sort of think, well, when I first came across it, and they have no. Well, if you say I had to sleep with the Bruce Forsyth lookalike, and there's a character in it played by Tracy Ann Overman who's a prostitute, but she only pays, but she only charges her husband for sex. it sort of gets people into the zone of where Toast lies.
Yeah, and it's sort of a parody of actors without it being, you know, it's not parodying anything. They're not really real characters.
Well, that's
acting,
the brilliant thing. There's a couple of things there. Well, one is Matt takes the piss out of actors. And when I first read it, I thought, is this just a niche? Is this just an industry humour thing? And it's gone so much wider than that. But Matt is not. I mean, he's not. His you know, he hasn't done much acting, you know. He's done well. He said that he said, "Oh, the greatest job I ever did was I worked in the London Dungeon on the Ripper tour, and you know, it's absolutely fantastic because you had all these Japanese tourists and stuff like that going around with you and through the streets and stuff like that, and then you'd eventually reveal yourself to be the Ripper and they'd all faint. It was fantastic." and that for him that was acting, you know, like that. And yet, you know, he does get under the skin of the nonsense and the vanity of and the craziness of doing that job, but yet he's not sort of part of it. It takes the best sort of satirists are slightly sort of outside the world that they're satirizing.
Yes.
Very often.
Yeah.
But he's absolutely got it, and he absolutely, and I love the fact that actors like it. There's no voiceover studio I've been to than isn't. I can hear you, Clem Fandango, scrawled up in the wall.
I love Clem Fandango so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then occasionally, you know, he's a very good actor, and he turns up in quite serious thrillers and dramas and things, and it's just so enjoyable to see him.
Yeah.
but if you haven't seen it, which it sounds like you all have in the room at least, do check it out. It is extraordinary. Hopefully, will there be more of that one? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, Matt's working a lot in North America and Canada,
right.
and his eyes, and there's a lot of, he did Toast of Tinseltown, and Americans were queuing up to say, "I can hear you, Clem Fandango." So maybe there'll be more. I don't know.
Maybe. The Bruce Forsyth thing is very upsetting.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
I mean, look, it's literally everything. Like, I'm interested in the Dad's Army taking on the role of John Lemez, wasn't it? In
I did two outings as John Lemez. I did one was I think I got the nod for the remake of the Dad's Army, rather restoration of the Dad's Army, because of that. I did a thing with Ruth Jones when she played Hattie Jakes. And I played John Lemez in that.
Yes.
And then, because of the 80 episodes of Dad's Army that were made in the 60s, six were taped over to make Panorama or something like that, you know, just sort of, because they didn't regard it as something that will ever be seen again. The tapes, these big chunky videotapes were taped over, and they found copies in various stations around the world. For most of them, but there were three episodes of Dad's Army which were never seen, and the completists among the fans of Dad's Army wanted to see, that they'd like to see them made, but of course they couldn't be made because the great heroes were dead. But so they got sort of the understudies in to play the parts. They rebuilt the War Machine on Sea in the studio, and in the audience there were, it was rather strange, there were... a lot of people in from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society in full uniform. all of them going, oh yeah, come on, let's see what you can do. And it was done faithfully to it. And we were just doing a restoration job. There's no point. There've been various Dad's Army things, and to my opinion, there's no point in remaking something that's available. There's no point in recreating the characters in a thing that Jimmy Perry and David Croft didn't write.
Yeah.
And so these were pure in the sense that they were the shows. They were shot as close as you could get to it as they were. And we all knew our job, which was to land the script, you know.
Yeah.
And the three episodes, they were restorations and they seemed to go okay.
Yeah. How does it feel to step into that? Presumably, like all of us, you watch these things as a kid, and you know I remember Dad's Army being, you know, I remember the Don't Tell Him Pike thing and how funny that was at the actual first time that it happened. But you know, you remember watching those with the whole family, and then to step into it and be in it.
Well, it was great because it was a through line to what they had to do, and that was really a thread which was really exciting to take on. And also you become aware that these sitcom writers, they construct comedy so well. I mean, I say Stephen Moffat is on a par with that. I mean, I think his comedy construction is unparalleled. So you're dealing with scripts which everything pays off, everything's set up and everything pays off. And so to do that was a real pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing, yeah. Well, it's a very interesting story of why that came up as well. Let's talk about Cold Feet. So things were going pretty well in your career, but the Cold Feet obviously was like, you know, sort of blew up so massively.
Yeah, it was the first of those sort of mega things. I mean, I've been doing loads of stuff. Yeah. I thought I was ticking over okay.
Yeah.
That was a different level, really, when it took off. And it didn't take off to start off with. It was originally a 50-minute pilot. Well, it wasn't even a pilot. It was a 50-minute one-off story of the Jimmy Nesbitt and Helen Baxendale characters, where Jimmy ended up with a rose up his bottom singing the love song. And that's how it ended, and that was where it finished. And nobody was talking about a series. We never got optioned for it. It was just deemed as a sort of a good one-off. And the other characters, the other four of us, were sort of satellite characters to the other two. And then they decided to make a series. Oh, that's right. The first episode, the one-off, went out on the night that Channel 5 was launched. I don't know, a Grand Prix overran or something. And in those days, you couldn't stream things. As if it overran, it overran. So we overran too. If anybody pressed their recorder, their VHS recorder, they only got half of us. Because we went out late. Of course, you open the papers the next day and you think, surely they must know that it's a fantastic bit of work. You know, how often has that happened? And nobody wrote about it. Nobody mentioned it. And I thought it was just another one, you know, that's gone.
Yeah.
And so then ITV weren't really backing it. And the guy, very briefly, I won't go on too long about it, but Andy Harris, who ran Granada Drama and stuff like that, he bullied ITV to put it in as their second string in the Montreux Awards, right, which is the big comedy, European comedy festival, TV comedy festival. And we were ITV's number two string in that. And we won it. It won the gold. And then ITV decided it was really rather good. and a lot of people started taking credit for it. And then they made a first series. And then we did five series in the first lot. And every year it was, because the previous series had worked, you know, on the sort of level of most people's way they calculate these things. And then there's always that moment, will this work again? You know, and for 5 years, every autumn or so, we could tell after 2 weeks that people in offices were talking about it.
Yeah.
And it took off. So yeah, and we pulled it after five series. And then there were four others recently, more recently.
Yeah. Is it going to be kind of thing that comes back every sort of seven up?
I wrote to Mike. I spoke, I had lunch with Mike, and I said, come on, you know. In a way, I mean, in 2026 will be the 30th anniversary of the pilot. And I thought, why not bookend the series? I mean, this is just me talking. I'm not speaking on behalf of anybody else. But, I mean, it just seems that people are invested in those characters. They've seen us when we've been relatively young and more middle-aged, and now we're going to be older. And I think there's some value in bookending the series with Cold Feet, the third age, if you like, you know, just to see, because there are all sorts of things that life throws at you as you get on.
Yeah.
But it can also be funny, and I just think that it can't be just a series of misery stories of things that happen as you get more and more decrepit. I think that there should be a good spark in there, and Mike's very capable of writing that.
Old Feet, you could call it.
Old Feet has been mentioned. Yes, exactly, sorry. Old Feet would be a perfect title for it, yeah.
But is that, I mean, I think the thing with you is you do so many different things that I'm sure that this doesn't happen to you. But when people have a very successful show and a very successful character, there's, you know, they can be haunted by it, and it can be like, oh, I don't want to go back to that because we've done it. But it feels to me that because you do, you know, you've done so much variety, even, you know, over the last 20 years since that started, that it doesn't feel like a burden to go back to the old thing.
Yeah, it wouldn't be, because, I mean, I love playing David, and I think there's juice in the characters.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about, really. I mean, that's the reason why we'd want to go back in, primarily. I mean, it would be, you know, be handy, of course, financially, but, I mean, but really, there's no point. Yeah, I mean, not just for that, but I mean, it would be... It would be really interesting to go and delve into those characters again, I think. And I don't believe people when they say, oh, I'm just recognized for this. It's terrible. It's just disingenuous. Ah, oh, shut up, you think.
Well, I think maybe, I think you're right. I think people should be, you know, when I had Michael Palin on this, it was just glorious that he loved, you know, he would recite some of the old sketches.
And he'd do Python sketches.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just lovely. And you kind of think, I know loads of people wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But it was just like, yes, this is what you should do. Some people love the thing you did, and he still loves it, and it's just perfect. But yeah, it is. I think if someone gets a character and then that's all they get to do, I mean, you've almost, as an actor, I think you've almost had the perfect career, haven't you?
I think it's more difficult in soaps.
Yeah.
I mean, soaps, you see, I mean, soaps, you're on for 5 days a week, whatever it is, for a year. And then it gets very difficult for people to accept you as something else. If you're in films, you're maybe seen once every 4 years. You know, now you might see Mike more once every couple of years. You might be seeing something. Telly, something like Cold Feet, you know, you're not on that much. And so but I think it's the saturation parts, the parts that people only want to see you in. I think that's where the trouble lies for actors.
Sure. And you do a lot of stage work as well, of course. You're working on, you've done it before, I think, haven't you? The Jeffrey Barnard is Unwell, and you're doing that again.
I'm about to do, I don't know if this podcast probably goes after it, but yeah, it's small scale, but it's something I've done before, and it's called Jeffrey Barnard is Unwell, which is, there's a character, he's a writer, journalist in the 80s and 90s called Jeffrey Barnard, who wrote a column called Low Life. he was an alcoholic, a gambler, diabetic, you know, he was just, and he wrote about life in the gutter in Soho. And Jonathan Meads described the column as a 15-year suicide note.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And he was very funny. And Keith Waterhouse wrote a collation of his work and set it in the Coach and Horses pub in Soho, which they did on stage. And Peter O'Toole did it, and Jimmy Bolam and all sorts of people did it on stage with four actors playing the scenes from his life. And I'm going to do it on my own in the Coach and Horses, in the actual pub itself. So we get 70 into the pub.
Brilliant.
And yeah, I'm starting that in a couple of weeks, yeah.
Brilliant. I'm sure that will come. I'm sure you'll do... That's quite a limited audience. That's where I should be. I might do my podcast there after you. Do a double bill. But you know, I'm sure that's going to run and run, isn't it?
I just like doing that show in the pub because it's like specific. When he says, I was arrested by CIA, he was arrested there. I mean, yeah. He's actually on that bar stool. And I love doing that. And also, it's quite fun because it's very hot in there. And a couple of times I had to stop the show because people fainted and I had to take them outside. and there was no one on the door and, you know, I had to sort of hold it up whilst we called the paramedics and stuff like that. So it's all very rough and ready.
So, yeah, so the audience become part of the show.
Yeah.
Maybe in their death. Maybe they'll die as we go. Look, I mean, there is so much to talk about. I mean, I'm, you know, you... You turn up in unexpected places. That's what I like about you, and I like that you do that. Like, you're in Mrs. Brown's Boys, which I wouldn't have pegged you down to go into Mrs. Brown's Boys. But
I will stand up for Brendan. And I did a film. There's Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie.
Yeah.
In which I played. I spent 6 years in Ireland in my youth.
Yes, that's right.
And so I played this sort of Trinity College Dublin barrister. A barrister with Tourette's. It was a subtle piece, and then he had me in for a New Year's Eve sitcom special up in Glasgow. We filmed it there. I did one of the sitcom shows, and I played Mrs. Brown's love interest in that, and put my hand on his knee, and my hand wandered under his skirt and got hit by a mousetrap. So that was another...
Good.
So it was... I Mrs. Brown is... I know, yeah, people are divided, but it's musical. It's Old Mother Riley.
Yes.
It's straight out of the musical. And he's great with his audience. I went to see him in Sheffield Arena. There he was with 8,000... Maybe we'd be jealous here. 8,000... 8,000 in the audience. I'm doing 8 shows a week at 8,000 people a night on a 3-month tour of 8 shows a week at 8,000 a night.
Yeah, he's got a lot of cast, though, hasn't he? I mean, it's his family, to be fair, but it's
got to. But he treats his audience so well. And he makes them all, and they're all. It's sort of critic proof. That's what I love about it. It's, you know, the bien pensants hate it. I mean, but there he is. Getting these numbers.
Yes, and you know, and it's about spread. You know, comedy, I think, and often can be forgotten, is about making people laugh and spreading joy. And I think whatever, you know, that is, if it's not your bag, you don't go and see it. But if it is your bag, then, you know, as you say, if you're making 8,000 people laugh,
yeah. People laugh very snotty about it. I went to a school in Ireland, and which was a really thuggish sort of school, and I was a boarding school, and I was 8, you know, I was too young and all that. And so I decided to exorcise the memory when I was doing Mrs. Brown, and I thought I'd wear the school leavers tie for the part as the barrister. You know. And so I drove up to this school and claimed the tie from the secretary there. And there were 3 teachers in there, one of them old and 2 of them young. And they said, "What do you want the tie for?" And I said, "I'm going to wear it in a film." And they all went, "Oh, wow, that's lovely." And they said, "What is the film?" They said. And I said, "It's Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie." And the 2 younger ones went, "Oh, bloody hell, what do you know, like that?" Because they obviously didn't like it. And the elder one said, "Oh, marvellous." He said, "Marvellous to have the school represented in a film about Queen Victoria."
It's interesting, the boarding, I did hear you talk about... boarding school, and it's, you know, it's something that I think is so endemic in our UK society, right? That I think you thankfully have not gone into politics, so you only play politicians. But like a lot of our politicians who then become MPs and become prime ministers have been through this horrible system of boarding school, and it seems it seems unbelievably cruel. My daughter's 8. The idea of sending her away to—I know there were reasons why it happened.
I mean, my mother was ill and she was in hospital for a long time, and maybe we were shipped off because of that.
Yeah.
I suspect that was part of the reason at that age.
Yeah.
But, you know, I spent 10 years at boarding schools. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a, is it, have you, you seem to be a well balanced and together person who isn't going to destroy the country to make up for your no parental love. But is that's them I'm talking about, obviously. But, you know, is that, it just, does it obviously still resonates that you made even that gesture, as lovely as that gesture is. It's, there's a feeling I've got to kind of expunge this from.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, yeah, because I mean, I wanted to see the place again. But, yeah, no, I mean, it is strange, the whole sort of boarding school thing. I was talking to an Irish actress who had a pretty bad time as well at a boarding school. And I won't give you the story that she told me, but and I said, how did that affect you? And she said, rather revealingly, she said, it made me very good at hiding.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, and also, well, you know, acting and stuff like that, there's a lot of hiding in that, and you've got to sort of, you've got to go into a different gear and slip reality and all that.
Yeah. And so do you feel comedy was helpful? Because I know you are a big student of comedy. What I love about you is you know, as you say, with the musical, you know all about the musical stuff, which is a tradition that is lost to a lot of people. But you've tried stand-up in terms of doing
character
research.
Stand-up, yeah. I mean, I like trying new stuff. I mean, yeah. I did my first, after 40 years in the business, last Christmas, I did my first musical.
Right.
And I played Scrooge in Dolly Parton's Smoky Mountain Christmas Carol. And we did that on the South Bank for a month. Right. And everybody else was musical theatre.
Yeah.
I had a number at the end with sort of a Scrooge redemption number, which I had to do on my own, and then it turned into a gospel song. I thought, I've never done this before. Yeah, give it a go.
Yeah,
and they had faith in me that I could do it and all that. But musical theatre people are of a different kidney, really. They are just extraordinary, and they work on a stave. You know, everything they do is on the stave. It's either singing notes or speaking notes, and the band are able to sort of they everybody knows where everybody is. Whereas I mean, they had numbers down there, and I was always hitting the wrong number. And if there was a pool of light, and I'd say, "Well, that's probably where I've got to be standing," you know, and just sort of go into it. And then the band would be, and I'd be doing my talking and then singing and stuff, and the band would be vamping away behind me, just sort of waiting for me to get to the right point and stuff like that. But it was fantastic. I mean, really loved it. I absolutely adored it, and I love working with musical theatre people.
Yeah, I mean, but that's good. When you have people on, when I look through, you know, you get the CV and you think, well, those two are made up, but the rest of it is probably real. You know, it's incredible. You know, I know you as a very successful actor, and I've seen you through the years, but it is this really rich career you've got. I mean, and I know there's going to be a lot more to come, but do you look back on what you've done and feel like pleasure at that? Because this is obviously what you wanted, right? When you started out and when you decided not to do That's Life, this is the career that you wanted, and you seem to have achieved it. Do you feel that?
No, I don't. I don't look back, but I haven't yet got to the bit where I like John Belushi, just sitting eating popcorn and watching his reruns. I haven't done that yet.
No.
But I don't look back, and I'm still ambitious, and I still want things to work, and to go into different things. And if somebody throws me an idea which seems odd, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'm glad. I'm very glad I didn't do that presenting job. But I mean, there've been huge disappointments along the way. I mean, there's lots of shows which have either haven't got or have gone to first series and haven't developed on and disappointment is the sort of you've just got to be prepared for that. And it's just almost like a weekly event. You just have to run with it, and that's the stock in test. That's what you get.
Well, it's interesting what you said about Cold Feet. You know, nearly disappearing after one episode, and that's often, you know, that's a lot of the things that are very successful. They get a rerun. Only Fools and Horses was a rerun before it, and The Office as well was a rerun. And so all these shows that could have been, there must be loads that didn't get the rerun and that would have been as good or could have captured the public imagination. It's obviously there's an element of fortune in there, but, you know, I think when you keep turning up in things that are successful,
my least favourite word in media is meat. You know, when a producer says, this is Mary Poppins meets Lawrence of Arabia or something, it's going to be a hybrid. It's just a sort of a bit of one and a bit of the other, and it's going to have no soul. And so I load that. But and that's an easy thing for execs to attach themselves to, because everyone can understand it. But what they don't have are the adjectives for originality. And that's where the art school comes in, and that's where you just have to go on instinct and what strikes you almost ethereally. And there are very few people who will commission those sort of things.
Yes.
And it's sometimes safer just to go for the hybrid.
Yeah, it's crazy though, isn't it? Because the things that become massive commercial hits.
Yes.
Like The Office or The Simpsons are those crazy ideas that are original.
Yes.
And you know that no one else is doing. So you would think they would go even just for. Like, if one out of ten of these become as successful as The Office, then I never have to work again. So, you know.
Well, Cold Feet was an example of something that was a hard sell.
Yeah.
I mean, when we first did it, I read it and I thought this is really good. And we were filming the first, and I was happy to talk about it to anybody who showed interest, you know, because I just thought, and of course, you know, people will blank, and until they've seen it, but I was doing the first. Episode of the first in the first series anyway, there was a scene when I was driving my Mercedes into the primary school car park, and I was just waiting for the action call, and there was a pedestrian extra supporting artist standing by the wing mirror, and we were having a chat waiting for the call of action, and she said, "So what's this series?" And I said, "No, it's a new series. It's called Cold Feet. It's about six people in Manchester." She said, "No, the Mercedes. Is it Series C or Series D?" So you know, you don't get anywhere with people until they've seen it, and then of course, Cold Feet was deemed to be Friends, and it wasn't. I mean, it was just it had six people in it.
Yeah,
but we weren't. They were in a flat. We were in Manchester. You know, and it was very, very different. And of course, and what was interesting was just to feel when people stopped saying Friends and stopped and started calling it as itself.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then you get later on in the series, you get people trying to make the new Cold Feet. Of course, having been so difficult to actually get the original Cold Feet on.
Yeah, but that's nuts.
That's the way.
But it's so nuts to me that people don't. The people who want to make money, which is fair, if they're investing money and stuff, they should hopefully get a return on their money. But they never seem to realize. They'll go for let's do the thing that's successful, never spotting the things that are successful. It's nearly always successful because it's not like anything else.
Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it's craziness. You've done a bit of directing as well. Is that something that you want to?
Yeah, I've always done jobs. I've always had opinions, and the opinions haven't always been welcome.
Yes,
you know, as an actor, you're not supposed to have too many opinions. Just do the words. And I got an opportunity to. I love horse racing, and jump racing in particular. And a jockey rang me up. A jockey who had made a film wanted to make a film. He was now a documentary, makes high end documentaries about racing mostly. And he wanted to make a drama about or dealing with and touching on the subject of jockey suicide. And there were two jockeys that year had died at their own hand. And he wanted to do something which would tell people what the pressures are that jockeys are under in terms of often in terms of social media and the pile-on they get. And so we collaborated on that. I co-wrote it and co-directed it with him. He'd never directed actors before, and we got these two really good actors to play the jockey and his partner. We made it, and it was a short, and it went down very well within the industry certainly, and the professional jockeys, and it's been shown on Sky and stuff like that. So people have watched it, and I really enjoyed the process of just going and not being behind in front of the camera. It was the first time I'd really felt just a particular scene, you know, and just to squeeze, get the moment and go and talk to them quietly and just sort of lead something out, which I think might be there, and make it theirs, but just to slightly sort of touch the tiller a bit. Yeah. And I really enjoyed doing that.
Oh, good. And so, and writing as well. So is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't write much drama. I mean, I write a lot of articles for stuff. Yeah. I write articles about various things. And there's an editor I know of a magazine. I pitch an idea to him, and he says yes or no very quickly. And so I just get on with it. And I do book reviews and things like that. So yeah, that's the writing I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a good life to me, Robert, that you've got, and you know.
Yeah, I know.
Live in Tunbridge Wells.
I've never met anybody in the profession who isn't sort of always just sort of looking around.
Yeah. You know?
And if you ever say, yeah, I've cracked it, you know, that's death.
Yeah.
And you're always looking, you know, like a pointer, like a dog in the park, always sort of doing that, you know, for projects. And and that's the only way to be, I think.
Yeah. But I think it's worth, you know, I get it, and it's the same for comedians, and, you know, I see very successful comedians who are still looking over their shoulder at who's doing better than them and who's doing, you know, whatever, or why they haven't got a certain job. But I think you have to occasionally sit down and go, okay, look, this has been, I'm not finished and I'm not satisfied, but this has been pretty good so far, which I hope you
well,
are doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've kept the family together and all that. And, I mean, it is. I mean, yes, of course, ambition aside, yes, I'm doing what I wanted to do in my 20s. So, yeah, in that sense.
And you played quite a lot of real people, obviously, like sometimes in comedies and sometimes in serious stuff. But you played Mark Thatcher
in something. We did that in South Africa. That was about the whole Equatorial Guinea heist. Yeah, but I've done. You know, I mean, the who else have I done? John Lemez and
King Charles. Was that in the comic strip?
An impression. I did a play by Mike Bartlett, which was in verse. I love working in verse. And this was really, really clever language, but clear. You know, I hate leaving audiences dangling on the sense of stuff. And this was really good. I did it in Chicago. They needed someone who'd been in Downton Abbey to play Prince Charles. and everybody else was American. I did it at the Chicago Shakespeare Theatre.
Yeah.
It wasn't an impression at all.
No.
The play is starts on the day the Queen dies, and when he takes it over and he refuses to sign some legislation about freedom of speech, and they say, what are you, an unelected toff, doing trying to take on the democratic process? And it's a good debate, but it's also a drama.
Yeah.
I loved doing it. I really, really enjoyed doing
that. That was before the Queen had actually died, right?
Yeah, no, it was written, about 10 years before.
Wasn't just, she's dead, let's get this play out there.
Is she?
She's unfortunately passed. Yeah, the news hasn't made the Tunbridge Wells Times yet. They've got more important things to cover here. So is there anything other than the Geoffrey Barnard coming up that you can talk about?
No idea at the moment.
No.
I'd like to take that. I've got to have it in my back pocket so that I can, when I'm not working, I can say to the coach, I'll do 10 gigs.
Yeah, it's
whatever,
brilliant.
Like that. And take it further. But now we'll see.
Yeah. And you're a very youthful man but you're still, is it a weird thing to suddenly be playing, or not suddenly, but to be playing these older characters and Geoffrey Barnard?
No one is the age that they want to be. I mean, I remember in my, you know, you go up for parts, and they say, you've got children in this advert or this scene or this thing, and you think, oh God, that's a bit advanced, you know, I haven't got any children yet. And then there comes a point when they say, now your kids have just gone to university, and you think, oh God, that's where I am. Yeah. And you have to accept it. Yeah, absolutely. And I relish it. Actually, I love. I mean, Geoffrey Barnard is a decrepit old soak. And,
yes,
you know, all that. And I'm looking forward to taking him on. Yeah,
it's fantastic. Look, it's so lovely to talk to you, Robert. Yeah, so lovely to see you again. And I hope Tunbridge Wells is very proud to have you living here, ladies and gentlemen. The amazing Robert Bathurst. Thank you very much. Go and buy my stuff. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Robert Bathurst. Scant regard, do the music, don't even know that yet. I do. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one or that one, and Ben Evans, not that one or that one. There's probably loads of Ben Evans, aren't there, if you think about it. Thank you also to Beck Cliff and George Lingford and everyone at the Assembly Hall Theatre in Royal Tunbridge Wells. I don't like Tunbridge, but I do like Royal Tunbridge Wells. This is a Sky Potato Fuss and Go Fuss and Strive.com production.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStripe.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.